I'm afraid I have some unpopular ideas. Our health is derived by letting go of fear and eating clean food and breathing clean air. I'm afraid I have some unpopular ideas to share. Some unpopular thoughts. You government officials are mostly just bought by oligarchic money bags, grinning ear to ear. I'm afraid I have some unpopular ideas right here.
I apologize for being a little winded. I walked all the way from Studio D to Studio A. It was... Yeah, it was a long way. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. Welcome to our panel. It is an absolute delight to have you with us, and we thank you so much for joining us. Ray and I were just talking about all the important reasons to support WAMC. One of the reasons you support WAMC is to keep this panel going. We want to continue to make sure that that is possible, and there's no better way than to actually have a panel and to do what it is that we do, and that is where we're headed this morning. We welcome you to join in, panel@WAMC.org, if you would like to... write to us. We love that, usually. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you. We will get started right away. Bob Brigham is here, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College, a specialist on the history of U.S. foreign policy. We will use you this morning, sir. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Always good to be here, Joe.
Wonderful to have you here. Vassar in the house again. Catherine Tan is an associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar. Her research is on health, wellness, and medical knowledge. Catherine, a great pleasure to have you here.
Hello, hello.
Thank you very much. There was a time when Bard was the college that was most highly represented, but
at one time.
I think you're still equal, but it's we have Bard and Vassar and Siena and Skidmore and UMass and Harvard and Albany, and I mean it's pretty good. This is great. It's not a contest. Please, no wagering. Malia Dumont is Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Good morning.
Good morning.
So good to see you. We also welcome Mike Spain, former Times Union Associate Editor, and the rock of this place, and is our Tuesday regular, and we're thrilled to have him each and every time he is here. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you.
It's really nice to welcome you all to the program. Let's go to items in the news. We'll be with you till about 10:30 this morning, so we'll try to get in as much as we can in a rather short period of time. But we can do it. I know we can. We can do it. And we also welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. Okay, so yesterday there was a meeting between the President of the United States and Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House, the Israeli Prime Minister. And at the end of that meeting, they agreed to a U.S.-backed deal to end the nearly 2 years of war in Gaza amid a fresh push by President Donald Trump. But obstacles to peace remained amid questions about whether Hamas would also sign on. I listened to this entire press conference yesterday from start to finish. And I kept on, because the president was obviously hyping the deal, and I kept on saying to my desk, I'm sorry, I missed it. What's the deal again? What have we agreed to? And then I thought I missed something. Well, not really. But anyway, so there's this 20-point plan that was revised from a previous plan. And now the Israelis have signed off on it, which was a significant moment in this conflict, which has been marked by deals and diplomatic initiatives that have quickly fallen apart. Well, the initiative agreed to Monday was notable because it appeared to have high-level Israeli buy-in along with assent from neighboring Arab nations. But it remained unclear, and this is a big but, it remained unclear whether Hamas would agree to a deal that would lead to its disarmament and potential exile from Gaza. Nor was it clear that Netanyahu could square his sharp opposition to Palestinian statehood with a plan that on paper could go down that road. Trump, speaking after more than 2 hours of meetings at the White House, betrayed little of that caution, declaring, with no evidence that the deal was likely to result not just in peace in Gaza, but a comprehensive restructuring of thousands of years of Middle Eastern relations. Trump called it a beautiful day, potentially one of the great days ever in civilization. I want to just have you think about that for a moment. Yesterday we had our greatest day in civilization. How did it feel? Bob?
Well, I think the essence of this deal is that the United States and Israel agreed to decommission and dearm Hamas. I don't think they're going along with this very well. It's interesting because there's parts of this that have deeper roots than Trump, even though Netanyahu politically knew he had to constantly stroke the president yesterday as this being his plan. But this isn't that far off from what Tony Blinken was doing 3 years ago. They've given up a lot of the things that Trump was doing with the Riviera deal and have included some of the Arab states' desires and wishes. Trump is going to sit atop this board of peace. It's also going to include Tony Blair, some Arab leaders. The one wrinkle that is interesting, I think, in this is this notion that the Palestinians don't have to be moved. That's some daylight from where the Trump administration was previously. But there's nothing here that anybody who spent any time doing or studying negotiations would recognize as a sustainable deal. Let me just give you an example. The analogy here is the IRA and the troubles in the north of Ireland.
Yes.
When you decommission the IRA and disarm the IRA, the goal, the deal, was based on the idea that Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, was going to have a shared part of the government. They were actually going to have dedicated seats. They would have ministers in a shared government. Hamas gets nothing like that. So I doubt very much that, you know, there may be a deal on paper. This might be even more than a pretext for Netanyahu just to do what he wants to do in the rest of Gaza City. But I doubt very much that this will end violence as for all time. The other thing, too, that I find very problematic about this deal is the thinking that the Palestinian Authority must so radically reform itself that it'll be unrecognizable to its followers and to people who were part of Oslo and the agreements that brought the Palestinian Authority forward. We have short memories in negotiations in this country. Hamas came out of overselling Arafat as a future in the Clinton administration, and I think you're going to have much the same here. If you have a reformed PA that doesn't have the same political standing with its people, and you have a decommissioned and demilitarized Hamas, what you have to me is you've just kicked the can down the road and offered a pretext to eventually more violence in the region.
Well, yeah.
Well, this is, I think. Perhaps the word deal is a misnomer. I think of it more as a statement of principles. And I actually find some helpful things in here. If we think of this as a statement of principles, that is the sort of opening of a conversation, I think there's actually some room for optimism. I don't think that Hamas is going to agree to everything that's stated here, but as a statement of principles, this includes several things we haven't seen before that indicate to me that, one, the Trump administration, whether they'll stick to this or not, who knows, but that the Trump administration is, for the first time with regard to Gaza, is talking more about the longer term and about trying to bring in Arab countries and to this extent to help sustain Gaza over the longer term. That, I think, is a positive indication. I think Qatar is very active behind the scenes, and I also think that's a positive indication because Hamas is not an independent organization. It can only operate in Gaza. It can only undertake its terrorist activities with the support of external actors, most of whom are in neighboring Arab states. So if Qatar and the Trump administration are able to open a series of conversations where some of the neighboring Arab states are willing to talk about some of these principles, this is how diplomacy works, right? It's not that a deal is announced and then everyone signs on to the deal. It's here are the things that we hope to accomplish, and then you go into, you know, behind closed doors and try to see where you can get with that. So I think as sort of an opening of a conversation at this stage of this horrible, terrible, destructive war, it actually has more elements that I think would help the people in Gaza than I expected, which maybe isn't saying much, but I think there's room for positive growth here and room for some helpful discussions. Now, the details obviously remain to be worked out. What is this board of peace that Donald Trump is going to head up? What are the timelines? I mean,
in his free time.
In his free time, when he's not busy running the Kennedy Center. but that's, again, I find there's some performative bloviating here with naming something like that. But I think I find some amusing irony and sort of positive irony in the fact that here's where Donald Trump thinks he's going to get the most accolades for his international work, right? And it's all about nation building and setting long-term conditions for it talks about, you know, the economic development of Gaza, which is exactly what his administration is pulling back from everywhere else in the world. There are a lot of contradictions here, but nonetheless, given his personal commitment, it seems, for whatever reasons, they're all personal, I think. It's all about, you know, redounding to his personal glory. But he seems to be committed to this process, and he's just articulated this set of principles, which actually has some positive longer-term aspects to it. So I'm cautiously optimistic, not that this is going to result in Hamas suddenly saying, yes, we agree, but that it's going to lead to a diplomatic conversation that is more than we've seen in the past 2 years.
Catherine.
I appreciate the optimism. Yeah, and you're right, the contradictions are all over the place. You have the Board of Peace over here, and then back in the United States, we have the Department of War and the Secretary of War. So there are a lot of mixed messages going on here. But yeah, he's really going after that Nobel Peace Prize. I agree that what this achieves is an outline of principles that or eventual goals. But at the same time, Trump is threatening, well, if Hamas doesn't agree to this, then, they will, the U.S. will have to give full support to Israel. So this is a proposal that Hamas will probably not sign on to, because what do they have to gain from any of this? I looked over the points, and it doesn't seem like they're getting anything. What do they have to gain from signing this. So I see it as an excuse for us to, you know, continue drawing out this war, continuing support, continuing the destruction of Gaza and the killing of people and civilians like women, children. It's terrible. It's been 2 years and 60,000 people have died, and that is a gross underestimation, and 167,000 people have been injured, again a gross underestimation. So I don't really see this as I don't know what this contributes toward or a step towards ending the ongoing war. And also the other thing I'm seeing is, you know, Netanyahu seems to have an incentive to keep this going, right? Because he's been, you know, charged with corruption, with war crimes. Like, the, you know, once this ends, the man might go to jail. So we have two, you know, we have Trump, who is a convict, and we have Netanyahu, who is potentially facing some serious jail time once this ends, who are just trying to keep their asses out of prison.
Mike Spain.
Yeah, all true. The interesting thing today is that New York Times and CNN have a poll out and about a whole bunch of topics and the way Americans are feeling about it right now. But part of that shows that the support among Americans for Israel is plummeting. Mm-hmm. And that has to be a factor also. Yeah, I think Trump is lobbying to look good and maybe lobby for a Nobel Peace Prize here. But it also is a recognition that it was the thing that really helped him in the last election, because Americans were fed up with the way the Democrats were wishy-washy about support of Israel and then supported them when there were so many images of people dying in Palestine, and that the Democrats did not seem firm on their support of the Palestinians, and Americans were getting fed up with it. And they turned to Trump, who promised to bring peace on day one, et cetera. And now I think they're getting fed up with Trump's administration and their handling of it. And that's applying a lot of domestic political pressure on the White House. I was surprised to see the name Jared Kushner, who's been instrumental in this, kind of reemerging. And he was negotiating with Netanyahu and his people yesterday to kind of add back into it a lot of ambiguities and maybe some modification of the deal, so to speak. And I understand that has a quote around it. But a lot of Arab countries were supporting this. And now that's a question, too. And I know Netanyahu has to go back home to his right wing factions and kind of defend this also and sell it. So it's I don't know whether we're going to see much of a resolution immediately. I'm very encouraged by, Malia and Bob's optimism. I hope there is a window there, but the likely of it is not something that we're going to hear about on Friday when Hamas announces they have agreed to all these terms. Yeah.
Well, I'll say the element for me that is sort of the key factor that isn't really explicitly stated in these 20 points is the attitude of the Arab countries, because that is, I think, one of the things that has changed the most over the past 2 years, that many of the surrounding of Israel's neighbors have stood by and watched this happen because they want Israel to damage itself, and there are things that they could have done to help the Palestinians in Gaza, but it's been politically helpful for some of these Arab countries around Israel to allow Israel to be the worst country that it could possibly be. Now that seems to be changing a little bit. I don't know to what extent that's true in these various countries, but the fact that there is more. There's more conversation now between those Arab states about how they're going to help Gaza endure, help the Palestinian people, and that they're willing to have a conversation about Hamas de-weaponizing, like that to me is really one of the key elements here. And yeah.
Bob. I read that just a little bit differently. To me, the Palestinians in the Arab world have always been like the Kurds. These are the folks that nobody really wants to claim. And what the Arab states to me like about this deal is it keeps the Palestinians in Gaza. So they don't have to have these huge refugee flows that then present political, economic, and cultural problems for them. And it's been that way for 50 years. So I think that's one of the things that the Arab states like about this deal is that Trump seems to be willing to give up on the Riviera plan, which required evacuation. And now they're going to say that, no, you're going to sit in place. But then the governance of that, that's still, if you listen to Netanyahu yesterday, it's most of the governance, most of the security issues are still going to fall to Israel, even with this board of peace. And so I think that's a problem. The devil is always in the details in these things. And will the details kill this? I kind of think they will. The other positive thing, I think, coming out of this is that the UN and the Red Crescent are going to be in the front lines providing aid. And there seems to be a commitment, and I agree with a lot of the things that Malia is saying here about the framework here is there. But here there seems to be an actual commitment to allowing these aid flows to return through these international agencies at a level that we haven't seen in years. And so that would be good.
But again, sure. The time frame is like when.
Yeah, you know. Exactly.
I'm not sure if there are assurances in here that Palestinians would be able to say, because it didn't seem like there was anything clear about the future relationship between Israel and Palestine and anything about statehood. So the vagueness is a little concerning. And then to put together this board of peace of unbiased or nonpartisan experts, I don't find that in assuring in any way, right? It doesn't, I don't know. I had a different read of it, that there weren't any assurances that people would be able to stay or that they wouldn't try to advance.
That is part of the agreement, that Palestinians can stay in Gaza. But they're staying in Gaza under a very strict security arrangement.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after that. They say hold on, but I just can't do it. Today came down before I knew it. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. The music we hear this morning is from the Mammals, our good friends. They have a new double album, Touch Grass, Volume 1 and 2. They're playing Studio 9 in North Adams, Massachusetts on the 3rd of October and the Bearsville Theater in Woodstock on November 1st. You can find out more information about the Mammals, Mike and Ruthie, themammals.love. themammals.love, and find out more. We also have the playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable.
And I just want to point out that Ruthie is a Bard alum. We were classmates.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. I should ask you to come sing with them?
Oh, I would love that, but my vocal stylings are not quite to that level. I'm a choral singer, not a soloist. So.
So I'm going to change the subject, and because we want to get a lot in here before our time ends. So I want to talk about the big meeting with the generals that was to take place today is taking place right now. In fact, Pete Hegseth has already spoken. The president of the United States is addressing senior military officials at Quantico as we speak. He has been for the last 10 minutes or so. Just some of the headlines to come out of this so far. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth summoned hundreds of U.S. military officials to an in-person meeting to announce directives for troops that include, quote, gender-neutral or male-level standards for physical fitness, as well as an end to woke culture in the military. Just some of the things that have been called on. I do want to go through some of the things that the president has said as well. We're a team, he said, and so my message to you is very simple. I am with you. I support you as president. I have your backs 100%. You will never see me waver a little bit. That's the way it is, the president said. That applies to police officers and firefighters as well. And Trump opened by telling the leaders what a great honor it is to serve as their commander-in-chief. Looking over at New York Times coverage on this, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth spoke before the president and received a muted reception while repeating a litany of points that found favor with Mr. Trump, including complaints about gender delusions and, quote, stupid rules of engagement. President Trump says he expected more fury from the left when he changed the name of the Defense Department to the Department of War. But he said in his view he has so worn out his critics over the last 10 years that they're just rolling over. Though Trump renamed the department, Congress has not yet approved that change. I've never walked into a room so silent before, President Trump says as he took the stage to address the military at Quantico. Don't laugh. You're not allowed to do that, he cracks before telling the members of the military that they are allowed to applaud, laugh, and even get up and leave if they don't like what they're hearing. Though he joked,
You'll be fired.
That's right. That knee slapper.
How did I know?
That knee slapper always gets them. And perhaps one of the most, I shouldn't say most, and one of the more telling moments, and I'll give the update here right up to the top. We'll take a break and then we'll come back and everybody can share their thoughts with this on this. President Trump took the stage and they were ordered there by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, an event to which Hegseth had not initially invited Trump. The president let his frustrations be known in his own Trump way. Speaking after Hegseth, Trump said that he thought Hegseth gave a great speech. I thought, great speech. I don't want him to get so good. I hate that, you know. Trump said in his opening remarks to generals, I hate it. I almost fired him, Trump told the senior officers. I said, you can't. I don't want to go on after that. The president was met by silence as he began his address to hundreds of senior military officers. Usually the president is used to rousing applause. I've never walked into a room like this. If you want to applaud, please applaud. You have to applaud. I need your applause. All right. And finally, as part of this update, President Donald Trump discussing the United States nuclear weapons capabilities discussed what he described as the two N-words. I moved a submarine or two. I won't say about the two over to the coast of Russia just to be careful because we can't let people throw around that word. Trump said, I call it the N-word. There are two N-words, and you can't use either of them. I'll let you ponder that. We'll take a break, and we will return after this and a visit to Lockbox Central.
Think your family's strange. Take a look at
good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Bob Brigham, Malia Dumont, Mike Spain, and Catherine Tan with us making up the panel. And we, right before the break, we talked about, I gave the background on the story, which we've been talking about a little bit, just setting it up that this event was going to happen today. And that is the in-person meeting with hundreds of U.S. senior military officials that is taking place at Quantico. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth summoned the generals to Virginia. he made what he said, he from the very beginning said this is going to be about a 20-minute pep talk. It was. Now the president has been speaking for somewhere in the neighborhood of 40, 45 minutes. And I'll admit, I'm not, we don't have the volume on in the studio for obvious reasons, although I'm trying to follow it on the, what do they call that, the closed captioning. And, you know, it's hard enough to always understand what is being said. So, but add that to it. So, when I see reports, I'll try to come in.
The New York Times reported 3 minutes ago that he's talking. The president is talking about tariffs, Joe Biden, the auto pen, the southern border, CNN, his personal feelings about Vladimir Putin, and his anxieties because he hasn't been given the Nobel Peace Prize he deserves.
Well, it covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. I mean, but these are things the writer points out that he talks about whenever he talks to any group. They've just become standard.
Yeah, he didn't get in yesterday. He did that on the speech with Netanyahu. Yeah. But he also got in the fact about the teleprompter at the UN. So yeah, that was one.
Right.
So there's more to come, perhaps.
And this is what four stars want to be doing with their day.
That's right. Yeah, go take care of the auto pen. All right. Who would like to comment first?
Well, why is this on TV? Why are we all the meeting itself seems like it could have been in an email, first of all. Second, if this is supposed to be a gathering of all the top leaders, shouldn't this be a moment of planning secrecy? Some you know, for it to be just projected, this is very similar to another one of his military parades, right? This is just a show, because nothing is really being achieved. We can see it right now. We're watching in real time, sort of, without the volume on in the studio. But nothing is.
I like you.
And what's happening in front of us, though, I think is really concerning, which has been going on for this whole time. But, you know, the military is supposed to be an apolitical institution. And right in front of our faces, Trump and Hegseth are up there basically saying, no, this is not apolitical. You guys will have to take a side. And Trump himself said, you know, he's going to fire anyone he doesn't like. So this is going against what the military has, the position that the military is supposed to take, as a, you know, for as long as they have existed. So that's my big concern, that what they're doing right now, without any shame or fear of being transparent, they are shifting the military and telling them, "Oh no, you're going to have to do what we say and take our side. This is no longer an apolitical institution." This is what they have been doing throughout our government, right? With the CDC, NIH, all of these other government arms and agencies are becoming politicized institutions when historically they are not supposed to be.
Well, yeah.
Well, I do have a lot of personal opinions about this. And first, I have to just emphasize these are my personal opinions. I'm not representing the Department of Defense or the United States Army Reserve. Just for listeners, I want to sort of clarify the various ways that this is really unprecedented. All the news reports have been talking about it. He's bringing together all the top generals. It's not only the top generals. It's also the senior enlisted advisors. And I understand, like, not a lot of people understand what's the difference between officer and the enlisted. If it were only generals, and it's not all generals, it's not all four stars, it's all the generals and fleet officers who are in command positions and their senior enlisted advisor. But if it were only the general officers and the fleet officers, then you would think, okay, this is a policy discussion because those are the decision makers. And officers have the unique responsibility of deciding which orders they should or should not follow. That is part of your charge and commission as an officer, to follow lawful orders and not to follow unlawful orders. The enlisted side of the military, which is the majority of the military, don't have that luxury of making a decision. You're given an order, you have to carry it out. That is what they do. And so all the people in this room, and I guess there's so many of them that the Pentagon Auditorium wasn't big enough to hold them, so they're doing this at the Marine Corps University in Quantico, have been, I'd probably the average length of service is 30 years, I'd guess. I know a couple of people in the room. I have a couple of people I suspect are in the room who wouldn't confirm to me if they were going or not. But have been serving their country in dire circumstances, risking their lives. And some of these people were yanked out of combat zones where they are overseeing the safety of U.S. troops to come back for this pep talk. I personally find that irresponsible, to say the least, and reprehensible. But the fact that the senior enlisted advisors were brought in as well, this really shows that Secretary of Defense, that's still the name of the department, the only place where it says Department of War is right outside Hegseth's office. He's changed the little signs right outside his office. But
And some stationery.
Some stationery, yes. But that the Secretary of Defense and the President really want to be addressing the entire force. It's not just a policy discussion. It's as Catherine said, I think there's a lot of performative work here, and the optics of them delivering these points to the entire military, not just the generals, but also the enlisted. It's like, I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but it's as if you brought together the CEOs of the top 100 companies in the United States and the union leaders from those same companies into the same room and sat them down and delivered this speech, I don't know what to call it, to them. So there's never been, I'm not aware of a time in U.S. history when all commanding officers and their senior enlisted advisors from all around the world, including in combat zones, have been pulled out of those duties on such short notice. And just for a little bit of further context, why is this happening now? The National Defense Strategy is getting close to being finalized. They've been working on it for a couple months. This is something the department is statutorily required to do by Congress. It's included in the National Defense Authorization Act, and they do it usually about every 4 years or more often as required. But I thought that President Trump was going to use this time to do a number of things. One, to announce, and we'll see, he's still talking, so maybe it's going to happen, that he was going to announce cuts to leadership. I think a lot of the generals showed up there thinking that they might not have a job when they left, mm-hmm. or they were going to be demoted. So that there was going to be some kind of loyalty requirement. I don't know how that might be implemented, but I expect that's part of what Trump wants to accomplish here. But also to emphasize the themes of the new defense strategy that they're working on, which is really echoing what we've seen in other parts of the Trump administration's foreign policy, really focusing on the homeland and pulling back the military from its forward postures in many places around the world. This is going to be really worrying to a lot of our allies. And I know that the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has been trying to convince the Trump administration that they shouldn't deprioritize the challenges represented by China. So that conversation is still ongoing. But I thought maybe he still will sneak some of that into this discussion. But I think President Trump just can't help himself. He's got this captive audience of some of the most impressive public servants this country has ever produced, sitting in a room silently listening to him. and he just can't stop himself.
Sean McCreish of the New York Times reporting, there does not seem to be a clear point or purpose in President Trump's address to the military generals today. It is a garden variety tear, bringing up many of the things that Mike mentioned just a few moments ago. Every so often he throws in a statistic or observation he has about the military, like, quote, "I think we should start maybe thinking about battleships, by the way," he said at one point in the middle of a riff about tariffs. "I used to watch Victory at Sea. I love Victory at Sea."
You know, I agree with Malia, and no one would know this issue, the national defense strategy, better than she would. And I think this is a missed opportunity. Dan Kane, lots of people have been openly critical of parts of this strategy, pulling, as Malia said, pulling out forward positions, Europe, Africa. They seem to be wrong in much of their analysis on China, using the military for domestic use. There is the rumor circulating that they're talking about a 20% cut to the number of generals and admirals. I mean, you could have used this. Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, some skillful politician would have used this moment to get people on board with who are being openly critical of this. But that's not what they're doing. I also think this is an enormous opportunity that missed, because morale at the service academies and the war colleges is really low following the cuts in the mandates of what's to be said and things, and how to teach and having your curriculum overviewed. You know, if you're going to have a pep rally, you should have that pep rally actually support the academies and the work that they're doing, because this is and the timing couldn't be worse. You know, you brought in all these four stars and others from all over the world at a time when the government's going to be shutting down tomorrow. I'm in a conference this weekend at Harvard, and we've got people who teach at the academies who are sure they're not going to be able to show up, and yet we're going to fly these folks for a pep rally. It's just...
Well, we have no reason to expect more than what's happening in front of us. Right. Like, this is classic Trump manipulating the optics to seem powerful or in control. And you know, that's what we're looking at. You know, he's standing in front of all of these leaders and using this opportunity to, well, squandering this opportunity instead of using this time with all of these people in the same room to do something substantive. He's putting on one of his shows to demonstrate, like, what a, you know, big bad, you know, leader he is, even though it's completely hollow. It's purely symbolic. And I wasn't expecting more than what we're observing right now. And I would, I mean, if I were in the room, I'd be so pissed being pulled away from my job to sit in this lecture that isn't going to go anywhere.
I don't know. I appreciate Victory at Sea being brought up. I mean, there's nothing quite like a 1952 television reference to bring it into the mainstream. Mike?
You know, I think back to yesterday, the roundtable, great panels yesterday also. Jim Ketterer quoted a plaque that's at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, which underscores how the military is committed to the Constitution, not to a person. And I thought that was, prescient, and it's important that we recognize that, and it has been, and we don't have coups, but it just must be very difficult for the people in this room who have, as you say, Malia, 30 years of experience or more, listening to a guy rant about his own grievances about the 2020 election and Biden and tariffs and things that have nothing to do with their mission, and that is to, you know, protect America and its interests across the globe.
Well, I personally think it's an insult to the troops overseas who are risking their lives right now because the United States asked them to, and that the president thinks that it's more important for the people overseeing those troops to sit in an auditorium and listen to him rather than be there in the field taking care of those troops. That's the decision he has imposed on these people. Well, it's not a decision. I mean, this wasn't an unlawful order. This is one of the issues, too. I mean, it wasn't an unlawful order that he said, you got to come back and listen to this.
It's unprecedented, not unlawful.
So it's, you know, a lot of disgusting things can happen in that gray area where you say, well, it's not unlawful. I really think this is horrible. Mm-hmm. I think I'm not serving my troops well by doing this, but I can't refuse to go. You know, you're only allowed to disobey unlawful orders, and those can be hard to understand, and they're few and far between. You know.
Well, that is all we have time for today, and I don't know about you, but that seems like quite enough. That's a lot of stuff that we talked about, a lot of big issues. We'll obviously have much more on this as the dust settles a little bit. I really can't believe he's still going, but that's another. We'll see what's added to the record here.
Meanwhile, there's the government shutdown counter right next to
Yes, yes. 13 hours.
He's going to keep them in there for the next 13 hours.
Quite a contest. My thanks to all of you. You're wonderful. I so appreciate you being here, Mike Spain, Catherine Tan, Bob Brigham, and Malia Dumont. You're wonderful. I appreciate you being here. I appreciate you, and we will be back right after this.